This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The war in Afghanistan has proved to be a very dangerous one for journalists. Today we're going to hear from two journalists who recently returned from covering the war. First, we talk with Sebastian Younger. He's the author of two bestsellers, The Perfect Storm and Fire, his new collection of essays, which includes a piece about Ahmed Shah Massoud, the leader of the Northern Alliance, who was assassinated by suicide bombers 2 days before September 11th. Younger traveled with Massoud and the Northern Alliance in the Panjshir Valley last year. This fall, he returned to Afghanistan to report for ABC News and Vanity Fair. He spent 4 weeks with the Northern Alliance. He was on the front line in the Panjshir Valley and was with the troops as they advanced toward Kabul. He says it was extraordinary when Kabul fell and Northern Alliance troops broke through.
It happened very quickly. The Americans bombed very heavily. Some advanced units went forward to occupy bunkers that the Taliban had vacated and retreated from, and then the mass of the Northern Alliance moved forward, just poured through the holes in the front line, and that's what we were part of. And it was part battle, part just wild celebration. We were moving down the highway, a convoy of tanks, Northern Alliance fighters on top of the tanks, on the turrets. Everything moving forward at about 30, 40 miles an hour, still fighting up ahead of us. They moved forward so fast that the front part of the column started to catch Taliban stragglers on the highway. They sort of apparently looked at each other in surprise and took a few shots at each other. And then the entry into Kabul was extraordinary because the population was just, as I said, just absolutely jubilant. They were flying kites. They were playing music in the street. They were digging up bags of chess pieces for their chess boards that they'd buried in their backyards because chess was illegal. All of these freedoms that you don't think of, they were indulging in as fast as they could.
You traveled with the Northern Alliance last year, and there's an essay about that in your new book, Fire. This time when you were with them, they were being helped by the Americans. There was the American bombing campaign, the whole American war against terrorism. How had that changed their strategy, the way they were fighting?
I'm not sure it changed it that much, except that it gave them the nerve to really go on a wholesale offensive and the confidence that it would work. I watched them. I spent a month with Massoud last year while he was counterattacking after significant Taliban gains that had cut off his supply routes. They were attacking with tremendous bravery and possibly even confidence, but they weren't getting very far. The Taliban were just too strong. They were doing the same kinds of attacks now, except it was working, and they were facing an enemy that was already demoralized, had already, I think, started to contemplate the idea of failure, of losing, and we're planning exit strategies, which is something I think the Taliban had never done before. A lot of the frontline troops that were captured by the Northern Alliance were Pakistanis, were recent volunteers who had just gotten into the country, who'd been in Afghanistan a week maybe, 10 days. And there was some suspicion that the recent recruits, the recent volunteers, were placed on the front line basically to slow down the Northern Alliance advance while the more senior Taliban made their escape, that already a week or two earlier they realized that at some point it was all going to collapse and they wanted to make sure they got out of there.
In your essay in the book Fire about traveling with Ahmed Shah Massoud, the head of the Northern Alliance, the head until he was assassinated in September, you were very enthusiastic about the Northern Alliance, particularly enthusiastic about Massoud. But lately we've heard a lot of reports about human rights abuses on the part of various Northern Alliance leaders. And there's a lot of concern that the people from Northern Alliance who end up in positions of power in a post-Taliban government might again turn to the kind of human rights abuses that they were responsible for before the Taliban took over. And that includes everything from checkpoints in which a lot of bribery is necessary to rapes and thievery. And I wonder if you have a different impression at all of the Northern Alliance now than you did a year ago, and if you're more concerned about possible human rights abuses in the future.
Well, of course. I mean, you have to keep in mind it was an incredibly chaotic country that had really just lapsed into a sort of feudal, a very violent feudal state. And there were commanders in the Northern Alliance and on all the sides who did horrendous things. But I think it's important to make the distinction between the individuals and the group. And the Northern Alliance as a whole, their ideals are good. Massoud called for democratic elections, for a multi-ethnic government for years, an offer that frankly was declined by the Taliban. And to some extent, they're trying to stay true to Massoud's vision. It's an awful shame that Massoud's not around to keep the alliance together, because they do have problems of unity. And even in the past few weeks, of course, there have been war crimes committed. There have been Taliban soldiers executed in the trenches by Northern Alliance soldiers. And of course, that's unfortunate. In any situation, that shouldn't happen. But a lot of journalists actually were surprised at how little that did happen. You could have had a situation where thousands were killed, given how strong the feelings were running after 5 years of fighting each other. The people killed were on the order of several hundred, I think, which is tragic, but of course it could have been worse. And there were even a lot of examples of the Northern Alliance stepping in to save Taliban from lynch mobs in Kabul. The population that had suffered under the Taliban for years really rose up and were trying to lynch some of the Taliban who were left behind in Kabul. And the Northern Alliance stepped in at times to save them. So journalism has to be careful about reporting the glass half empty or half full. I think both of those situations should be reported. And I sort of have to think, as an optimistic human being, that any government is capable of doing good or doing bad. And this particular government has to be encouraged and supported. And hopefully they will follow the right path.
Let's talk a little bit about what this war has been like for journalists. Several journalists have been killed in Afghanistan. What are things that make covering this war particularly risky?
Well, I think the most dangerous thing in this war right now was the fact that it was such a big story. Hundreds and hundreds of journalists poured in there. So you had inexperienced journalists, some of whom had never been in a war before, covering a country that is exceptionally chaotic and sort of freewheeling. I mean, the Northern Alliance fighters were, you know, if you wanted to ride on their tank, you just get on their tank and they'd go forward. You know, they were very, you know, their attitude was very much, okay, if you want to get yourself in trouble, feel free. We're not going to stop you. And journalists generally are not used to that kind of freedom. And the journalists who got killed, with one exception, they were doing things that, frankly, I wouldn't have done. They were driving. Four of them were killed on a road between Jalalabad and Kabul in a situation where they thought the Taliban had been defeated. But, of course, it's not black and white. Particularly in Afghanistan, nothing's black and white. There are a lot of Taliban units still roaming around. It's a chaotic country. And they didn't stop to think that that road wasn't secure. And it was a tremendously dangerous thing for them to do, and they were just ambushed. They weren't killed in a frontline battle. They were just ambushed. The journalists killed in Talokan, they were on top of a Northern Alliance tank, and they're going forward at night in a battle zone. I mean, that's a liberty that very, very few armies will grant you. And they basically got themselves in trouble because they were sort of living a journalist's dream. My God, we can go forward with the tanks, and they really shouldn't have been.
But you were on a tank going into Kabul, weren't you?
We were behind the first tanks, and it was in the daytime, and it was a much more, as far as we could tell, it was a much more stable situation. What we heard on the military radios was that the Taliban lines had completely collapsed, and even so, we were worried about it. And we made a decision that we may have lived or not lived to regret. But it seemed okay. And there are points where you just have to take a risk because it seems so important. What I wouldn't have done was to do that at night. Nighttime is a whole different thing. And there was a point when night fell on the highway to Kabul. There was fighting up ahead, and we decided we wouldn't go any further because it had gotten dark.
So when you decided, because it was dark, that you would just wait where you were while the Northern Alliance men went forward. Did you end up alone on the road that night?
No, we actually pulled back. We went back to our base in Bagram. And one thing we were worried about was the entire Northern Alliance army being cut off on the Shamali Plain as they rushed headlong towards Kabul. And it wasn't inconceivable. And that really worried us. They could have cut off 10,000 men there. Massoud had done the exact same thing to the Taliban a few years earlier. They had broken through in that same area, but going northwards, of course. And he pulled back. His men went up into the mountains. He let them come in. And he came down out of the mountains that night and cut them off and killed hundreds of them. The Taliban easily could have done that, and that they didn't shows a real collapse in their command system and frankly, in their will to fight. It's something that I think militarily could have easily been accomplished, and the Northern Alliance were taking no precautions against it that I could see, and we were all extremely worried about that.
Now, you've reported that there's a lot of journalists in Afghanistan who'd like to get out, but they can't. What are some of the problems journalists are having getting out?
Well, right now, I'm not sure because I haven't been there for 10 days. When I was there, the snows had just started to fall in the high mountains, so the passes were closed. Even without the snow, it was a four-day drive, absolutely brutal drive on not even dirt roads, just through the mountains, through streams, through everything. And now that four-day drive was lengthened by the fact that you would have to drive to the bottom of a pass and then cross over on horseback over 14,000-foot passes and then continue on the other side. I mean, a real odyssey. The alternative was to take a helicopter, and these helicopters were run by the Afghan government and were used to ferry ammunition and all kinds of things in and out of northern Afghanistan from Tajikistan, an area where there are very few roads. The spaces on the helicopter were hard to come by because there were hundreds of journalists and a lot of them needed to get out. So there were actually brawls that broke out on the airstrip between journalists trying to get onto these helicopters. The Afghans were to watch this sort of alarm and amusement. They'd never seen Western journalists brawling before. In fact, one Afghan said to another, this was overheard by a friend of mine, he said, "These are just the journalists. Imagine when their soldiers come here, what they're like." I think, in fact, the soldiers are acting a good deal better than a lot of the journalists did. I think there was 130 people waiting on the list to get out, and these helicopters only took, you know, 8 or 10 people at a time with their gear. And they only flew when the weather was clear, and the clouds would move in for days at a time sometimes. So there was actually a sort of rising panic among the journalists that they could just simply be stuck there all winter. It didn't happen, obviously.
One of the people I think you met on this trip was Massoud's son. Yeah. Massoud, again, was the leader of the Northern Alliance until he was assassinated in September. What's Massoud's son up to? Where does he live? What are his plans? And what are the rest of the family's plans?
Well, Massoud's son is 13. Sort of 13 going on 40. I mean, he had a presence and a dignity that I think I've rarely encountered even in other adults. Just an extraordinary kid. I mean, he just incorporated his father into him. He's in grade school. And we saw him in Dushanbe in Tajikistan, where he's getting good education, with some political ambitions in Afghanistan. I mean, he clearly was sort of urged by his father, if not instructed by his father, to think of himself as a possible leader for Afghanistan in the future. I mean, you think that the Taliban killed his father, and this country has been at war for a long time. You consider those things, and then you'd hear what he said. I was really moved almost to tears. He was saying, you know, peace is the only way. And my father was a great fighter, but he didn't want me to learn anything about the military. He said, my world will be a peaceful world. And I'm studying now because that's the way I can best make use of my life for my country, is by being a learned and fair man. And I won't need to be a fighter. My father promised me that there'll be peace when I'm grown up, and I want to lead our people in a time of peace. And to hear those words coming out of a 13-year-old was really I think, one of the most extraordinary interviews I've ever done as a journalist.
Well, Sebastian Younger, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Sebastian Younger reported from Afghanistan for ABC News and Vanity Fair. His new book is called Fire. This is Fresh Air.